13, focused on the difficulty of communion with faith in an age of disbelief, solitude, and profound anxiety. I guess that must be just standard equipment through the ages. Anyway, the poem I want to read in German is Über Kunst, or On Art. And it essentially does two things for us today. It tells us how to live our lives as pieces of art, and it tells you pretty much what I'm going to say to you when I speak later. Not any self-control or self-limitation for the sake of specific ends, but rather a carefree letting go of oneself. Not caution, but rather a wise blindness. Not working to acquire silent, slowly increasing possessions. And this is the part I really like. But rather a continuous squandering of all perishable values. A continuous squandering of all perishable values. That's real though. Recently, Katie and I were in a gay pride parade in Tulsa, and I got out my beautifully colored Taos P flag bracelet, the one I got at the Seco parade, and wore it with pride. While waiting for the parade to start moving, a friend on our float began to tell us a book about finite games and infinite games. And the setting couldn't have been more apt, as you'll see as we float along together today. But to give Rilke's poem its due, it should be noted that all the floats were lined up before us, covered with work that we could call art. And there were all the people on the route, perhaps 20,000 of them, all covered with adornments and tattoos and writings that we would call art. And then there were the people. That sounds like Ma Joe. The people, they just keep coming. And there were the people. And they were, of course, art themselves. And to explain this coming together a few weeks ago, there was the parade project itself. One to express our commitment to and love of people without regard to whom they love. So what exactly, you ask, is a finite game? And why title this sermon about play and possibility? Well, sit back and relax and hark back to a time long ago, to a gender-fied era of televised pageants of beauty. And behold there, a finite game. You know it. You know how she responds. You've heard the question. You've heard the hackneyed answer many times. If you could have just one wish, what would it be? And what does she say? I'm reluctant to act this out too dramatically. Bill Murray could do it much better. But it's something like, I would wish for world peace. But really, what kind of world would that be? What kind of a world would it have to be? Would it be a world where there were no disagreements, arguments, war, suffering? Would it be a world where there were no futile striving, no unrequited love, no frustrated hopes, no unfulfilled dreams? This kind of analysis might be called hypothetical nullification. It suggests that something about the way we are as humans would have to be left out of such a world. But it suggests, too, that this something might be on balance, something we might like to hold on to. Perhaps this dilemma of sorts cannot be escaped. For after all, what would it mean to live in a world where there were no competing interests and no tension-filled arrangements of people, where all of their aspirations could not come true simultaneously? This kind of analysis might be called stretching a point, but the dilemma remains. It seems we really can't have it all. Miss America herself might show us that. After all, she's just one. And there she is, as the song goes, speaking to the world from center stage, basking in the bright lights of fame. While if you look closely in the darkened background behind her, you see there are the ones whom she's just beat. The losers, as they are delicately called, they are a necessary part of a finite game. Such a game is one where the participants choose to play, where there must be opponents, where there are rules, where there are eligibility requirements, time limits, and most significantly, where when the time is up and it comes to an end, there is a winner. Determining the winner is the whole point. And everyone agrees to give the winner the title, if even begrudgingly. And we know about that. And now it's time to go home and begin to think about dinner. Is that all there is? Do our dilemmas stand utterly in the way, rebuking us for being so optimistic, so silly for imagining that there might be a model for a better way to be? I think there is one. It's been used effectively throughout all of history in behalf of marginalized and oppressed peoples everywhere. And better yet, it's a model that each of us can use in our own lives. This model is the infinite games that my friend told me about back at the parade. It's what James P. Carse, it's like cars with an E on the end. So yes, I'm talking about that particular James P. It's what he writes about in his book, Finite and Infinite Games. Anyway, as I listened to my friend on the float, it occurred to me that seeing myself as a player in an infinite game made things so much easier. This was like an epiphany. Sometimes they're wrong, but often they're forceful in any event. There was something timeless and organic and value-driven about, well, to pick an example near to hand, about seeing my life with Katie as an infinite game. In this game, the criterion for my participating would be simply, what should I do to keep it going? The simplicity was overwhelming to me, and in sensing that, I felt I could see all the way through, with one very long lens, but in one very real picture, all the way to my own end and to the time beyond. Much of our lives, as you might have guessed, is arranged as finite games, and I'm not suggesting that we should avoid them or that they're unnatural. When something is really a game for us in the sense that it's a diversion, the game focuses our attention and takes us out of the moment. That's the moment, you know, that we're supposed to be in so much. And focused as we are, we can get a lot of gaming done. Or, in another way, a lot of work, if that's the game we're in. Attention must be paid. Things need to be done. Our jobs are finite games. I think maybe we learned this in kindergarten in the parable about the grasshopper and the ant. And ever since then, all of us busy ants have been being graded for our busyness. But to be fair, finite games work in their own realms. In the same way that their characteristics led to our crowning Miss America, they lead to results that are driven by rules. And I think we often take this to mean predictability. And generally speaking, that's true. The more we know of the rules, the better we can predict. Obviously, it's not fail-safe. I can't avoid that subtext, and it's not really, it doesn't really have to be. But this certainty, this predictability, we imagine, can salve our anxiety about our futures. But I think it doesn't. I think there is no easy way to sidestep the dilemmas, the ones telling us that hope is futile and that humans are strong-willed, often difficult, sometimes incorrigible. But there is a way. It's just not an easy one. There are useful games that are not time limited. These are the infinite games. They are games for a life lived beyond the necessity for certainty. They leave behind a winning effort aimed at wealth or status or power in favor of ensuring the continuation of play itself. This is a meta world where the rules may change, even the participants, but the game never ends. Indeed, to take another meta step, the very knowledge that the game will continue, that's the objective, as I suggested with my example about Katie, that knowing that that's the objective can itself guide our actions, can give us a standard of how to be. If you're in love with someone or something, a project, or try this congregation, then the game plan is to do what keeps the love continuing. So what's an infinite game got that a finite one doesn't? For one thing, it avoids the seriousness of our day-to-day lives, and it opens the door to a more subtle, more playful way of being, to an arena of much greater possibilities. The joyfulness of infinite play lies in learning to start something we know we cannot finish, to take that risk, because otherwise it will not be taken up. Infinite players do not win titles so that they may be known, so that they may be immortal. Instead, they play as mortals in games that will continue after they have died, and instead of titles, they have only their names. Finite play is contradictory because the players desire to bring play to an end. They want it to be over, to have won, and to go home, to do something less serious. Infinite players desire to continue play precisely because they believe in the goals that continuing to play will continue to serve. The Miss America pageant was a time-limited game, a contest of beauty and poise and talent. But it was most decidedly not an effort to achieve world peace. It was serious. It was serious because the players had chosen it as a way around the dilemmas. They had chosen it as a way to search for certainty. They imagined they could create a diversion from a life of meaningful values and substitute for it an abstraction, one built on a bed of rules, a smaller one that would give them meaning and a title, and would shield them from anxiety about what their life was really for. Making such a decision to devote yourself to a finite game that is itself an abstraction has one major drawback. It commits one absolutely to endowing the new, created, finite game with seriousness. You know, if you're going to spend most of your life seeking gold medals in swimming in the Olympics, you're going to spend 11 or 12 hours a day turning yourself into an outboard motor. You definitely need to understand that it's a very serious undertaking. You're obliged to do that. That's built in. Thus, the players' lives become nothing more than the abstract game they have just created. And so, in turn, a winner-driven game comes to stand in for life. We learn to demand a prize at the end. Our sense of what can be accomplished in this world becomes fixed. The future is limited. When it's over, it's over. Our sense of what ought to be accomplished, of what is possible, becomes unfortunately entrained to the rules. And everyone knows that you can't change the rules in the middle of the game. And so values are left behind. When I wrote that, I also wrote, objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. I'm not sure how that fits. I saw a cartoon once where the person driving looked in the rearview mirror on the right, and there was an eyeball. It was that object was even closer than it appeared. Everything about our ways of making a better future for us and for all those who will ever live with us suffers from this finite game fixation. Our optimism, our courage, our playfulness, our still as not yet fully formed hopes for the future, our willingness to envision and then to make long-term commitments. Evidence for this suffering is all around. The middle class suffers as executives heed only the next quarter's numbers and their own salaries. The workers' hopes for continuing employment be damned. The effectuation of the climate accords, indeed the world itself, suffers as countries gauge their short-term economic interests as predominantly important. So, I say, with all the authority I can muster, to hell with the rules. Let's imagine a world with infinite games, one where the rules are there to promote a never-ending continuation of play, where when we see that there is about to be a victor and a spate of losers, let's look into what the rules are trying to accomplish. Let's rewrite them as we go, on the fly, to keep the game alive, to keep alive a continuing relationship among the players. Let's be less concerned about rules for the finite game players, the serious ones, and let's instead be playful enough to relate as joyous, free persons, having a relationship that is open to surprise, one where everything that happens is not serious, but instead is of real consequence. Here is where someone in the back, it's always somebody in the back, you know, the woman who stands up in the joke that ends up where she explains that it's turtles all the way down. Somebody stands up and says, "Can you give us some examples of an infinite game? And are you saying that all finite games are frivolous or trivial?" Well, to the second question, the answer is no. An economy requires finite games, and not everyone can be an electrician or a teacher or a certified mechanic or a brain surgeon or play for the Yankees without the approval of their potential colleagues and competitors. They need rules. And now to the first question. And there are many examples here of infinite games, and I've mentioned a couple, but here are three more. One involving women, one involving Jews, and one involving Black Americans. All of them groups who've been marginalized, if not worse, by a vision of a world that created not only the games and the rules, but also the winners and losers they produced. In 1982, a Harvard-based psychologist, Carol Gilligan, published In a Different Voice. There she espoused a care-based ethics, one a lot different from earlier systems about how to act in this world. She explained with completely justifiable glee that the then much vaunted six stages of human moral development were bankrupt. They had been put together by men, they focused on abstract principles and a stern sense of moral duty. And under them, it was unusual for girls to reach the sixth stage of moral development. Most of them stopped at three. In its place, she proposed a maternal, care-focused ethics based on spontaneous feelings of caring, compassion, intimacy, and empathy. And it became known as feminist ethics. It was soon followed by Sharon Welch's book in 1990, A Feminist Ethic of Risk. There she, as Gilligan had done, left behind a patriarchal world of linear thinking, one that led people and governments to avoid repairing the world where the effort could not guarantee success. You can see how politicians might be reluctant to start a project that can't finish. Efforts followed under this ethic of risk, like embarking on a nuclear non-proliferation program. I've got that backwards, I'm sorry. Those were the kinds of efforts that governments would not pursue because you couldn't see the end and you couldn't guarantee success. It couldn't be done in a linear fashion. Men couldn't say, this is how it can be done, because the problems wouldn't submit to the finite models for how to get there from here. The problem of building an atomic bomb, you see, it would. But what luck. But women could do it. They would take the risk of starting something whose end could not be promised or even seen. And I have to apologize for this dichotomous presentation between men and women, because I understand it's all really much more on a spectrum. But back in 1982, this was the vision. Women could do it. They could take the risk of starting something whose end could not be promised or even seen. They started Mothers Against Drunk Drivers in 1980, and it worked. Drunk driving problems were not eliminated, but they were substantially reduced by 50%. And as difficulties in the MAD model arose, they changed the rules to stay ahead of the surprises that kept occurring. They knew there would be some, and they were ready to stay engaged, to change the rules to make sure that their infinite gain would continue. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of our heroes, is, by the way, engaged in the same venture as RBG, the movie, reveals. I'm told that. I haven't seen the movie. And you have. Okay, good. She, along with a lot of others, men and women alike, are devoted to continuing another infinite game, one based squarely on Gilligan's and Welch's feminist ethics, and it's called legal feminism. And, of course, she's got some help on the bench. Another example, black Americans in the 1960s were not assuaged by the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act. The new laws were good ones, but they couldn't change the racism that underlay the inner city riots. Racism was not a finite game and couldn't be changed with new finite game rules. What was required was a social and cultural transformation that would permit black people to be seen and to see themselves in power. Whether she imagined being engaged in an infinite game, Elaine Brown, then the chairwoman of the Black Panther Party, had this to say about the possibility of transformation of America's racism. What she said could stand as a prologue to the mission statements of charitable organizations worldwide. If you are committed, if you seriously make a commitment, and that commitment must be based not on hate, but on love, then you're going to have to realize that this may have to be a lifetime commitment. So don't get hung up on your own ego and your own image and pumping up your muscles and putting on a black beret or some kind of Malcolm X hat or whatever other regalia and symbolic vestment you can put on your body. Think in terms of what you're going to do for black people. I'm saying that these are the long haul. The game will continue as new rules help people to find new ways to be in relation to each other and to respond to the hoped-for surprises, perhaps like the ones in the new movie Black Panther, whose success arises from showing black people in power. Here the surprise is not only that the movie has the sense to do that, to show people, black people not in power, black people in power, but not because of paternalism or patronage or condescension, but because of the way they are. The meta surprise is that so many who thought they were racially even-handed now know that they weren't. They see now the surprise that their tidy world of race relations had not yet got there, which is probably true for almost all of us if we look deep enough inside, of whatever color we might happen to be. And they can see this because they can now see, having watched the movie, what there looks like in a movie acclaimed universally. The third example involves a Jewish concept, Tikkun Olam, which translates roughly as repairing the world. It's an entreaty to do just that every day, despite the certainty that the world will never be fully repaired. It's a MAD occasion all over again, albeit one that Jews have pursued for a very long time. Aside from the good work it engenders, its beauty lies in the sidestep that it permits, relieving one from anxiety over not doing the impossible. And finally, it captures ideas current in other Jewish thinking, including two dimensions of some Hasidic teachings. I know you didn't think we'd get the Hasidic teachings today. Those people in here with long black beards who disagree with what I had to say, we'll chat later. But the first of these teachings is the belief in God's immanence in all aspects of the material world. All dimensions and aspects of reality are infused with God. And this belief has the view that joy is the preferred human attitude. Earlier attitudes had been to adopt a severe, melancholic one as a safeguard from temptation and sin. I guess I'm too depressed to sin. But joy worked better, as you might imagine, for it could be expressed with the body in music and dance, and even in the darkest of circumstances, it could turn into a defiant posture. An effort was made during World War II in the Warsaw Ghetto to record daily life for posterity. The precious documents that resulted were sealed and buried in milk bottles. Now unearthed, these notes show that near a small synagogue there a large banner had hung that said, "Jews do not despair." The writing then goes on. The Jews there dance as they did before the war. A man whose daughter had died the day before danced the next day after prayers. It's a surprise for sure. Joy become defiance. And the second fundamental element of this infinite sensibility was the idea to enlarge the sphere of religiously meaningful acts to include mundane secular activities. And this idea blurred the line between the sacred and the profane, and as a result, every activity performed with the proper consciousness could become a meaningful religious encounter. These two Hasidic sensibilities appealed to new thinkers since then, such as Martin Buber, who saw in them a path to re-enchanting the world, in opposition to the spread of, now are you ready for this?
Yeah.
To the spread of what might be the greatest evils of the world today. That's intended to be a bit of an understatement. Re-enchanting the world in opposition to the spread of technology and instrumental reason. I take instrumental reason to mean the rules designed to govern all the finite games in the world. Here's how you must be to perform, to get from here to there, to succeed, to win, to be done, and then to go home for dinner. And so this Jewish tradition presented an openness to revelation for people encountering the most mundane matters. For Buber and others, including us, the tradition put at its center a continuous possibility for wonder. If Hasidic Jews can pull it off, surely we Unitarians can too. Let me conclude this way. I remember talking to Joe at the parade. Here's a new perspective on such things. It sets me free from imagining that difficulty must be worked out on a timetable, from imagining that there will be no surprises, from fretting over not having anticipated them, and from fooling myself into thinking I'm serious in a life where being playful might be more creative. Put more affirmatively, it gives me the criterion for all my decisions about how I might act in my relations. Simply put, I should do all I can to make them continue. And I should trust, this is an important piece, I should trust that the others are doing this too. A felicitous, positive feedback loop, to be sure. I can feel strong because I can allow others to do what they wish in the course of my play with them. That we are all in this together is part of the game. And thus my future will unfold as it does for many reasons, including how everyone chooses to play the game with all the others, including me. I play so as to keep the game going, and I see that I can play most effectively as I age, for as I become less necessary to the continuation of play, I will be able to play most freely. Mm-hmm. Think if that describes you. There are a few older people here, I know. On this, think of how your relations with others have evolved over the years. Can you sense in your own changes that your life is, like Rilke's art, something dramatic, not theatrical, I hope you respect the players, Something always opening forward, something beginning that cannot be finished. There are no scripted roles for us, and the absence of any finite rules for performance constitutes, precisely because of the absence of rules, our lives as art. We can watch what persons do and discover the artistry in it. Infinite players prepare themselves to be surprised by the future. They play in complete openness. It is not an openness as in candor, but one as in vulnerability. It does not expose one's unchanging identity, but rather one's ceaseless growth. I like the idea of a congregation being engaged in an infinite game, evolving in step with all the actions each takes with all the others, all working to keep it going continuously. The values, which cannot be sidestep, which are an essential piece, are community, service, and love. The horizon is whatever we can imagine, and it is not a limit. It is not an ending. This can all be done by a congregation working together with laughter, playfulness, and an eye peeled for the possibilities of surprise. Thank you.